allowed using any kind of contraceptive methods, pills, like say condoms, and these are the things, okay, which are very commonplace.
Yes. Back in those times, actually, there wasn't any other method.
Yeah,
was there
wasn't any other method, yes, except coitus interruptus.
Would you please, kind enough to explain about it briefly, because it sounds Latin and some of the audience might not know it.
You're right. You know, coitus interruptus is the practice of withdrawing before orgasm, okay? Mm-hmm. When a man is about to ejaculate and he is at the pinnacle of having the ejaculation take place, okay? There and then he withdraws, mm-hmm. and then the ejaculation takes place on the outside
of the womb. Yes,
of the womb.
Yes,
this is this is what coitus interruptus is. So there's no objection to such a practice, and so based on this narration, actually, the religious authorities have concluded that using any contraceptive methods is without any problem.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Ashtavit. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away. Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shachavid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Shachavid, is it permissible for a pregnant woman who wants to be sterilized to have a cesarean so that the procedure of sterilization can be done at the same time?
Well, we have already discussed its sterilization. As for the cesarean, going for it or not is dependent on the need for it or the request of the pregnant woman. At any rate, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it is haram for a non-mahram man carrying out the operation to touch or look at her during both procedure, unless in necessary cases in which it could be permitted. Otherwise, when it comes to the cesarean, the operation, it is permissible, but the preliminaries like touching and looking, those are the things which are forbidden and should be avoided. Mm-hmm. Only in the case of necessity, they could be permitted.
I see. Is it permissible, Sheikh Javid, for the woman to use contraceptives without her husband's permission?
Well, his opinion, His Eminence is of the view that it is problematic. Mm-hmm. You know, the woman should talk to her husband and see whether he permits it or not. If he permits, there's no problem. Otherwise, it's a matter of ishkal. Ishkal means that it's problematic, and you know, the woman cannot do it.
Mm-hmm. I see. A man with four children underwent an operation of vasectomy without his wife's consent. Is he guilty of not obtaining his wife's approval?
Well, first of all, let's understand that the husband does not need his wife's permission to go ahead and have any kind of operation, like, for example, operation of vasectomy or any other kind of using contraceptive methods. It's the permissibility of such a thing does not depend on the consent of the wife, And he is not liable if he goes ahead and carries out the operation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, since giving birth to a child and having children is a matter or decided by both parties.
Exactly.
And it has a tremendous impact on the
mm-hmm.
happiness of the family.
Yes.
So it's very good. Morally speaking, it's very important for both parties to the marriage to consult each other, to achieve each other's consent and take action with both parties agreeing to it.
Exactly. It's a family issue.
It's a family issue.
It needs to be agreed on,
yeah.
By both parties, as you said.
But, you know, having vasectomy to avoid pregnancy or to avoid having any children is disliked according to Islamic Sharia, because Islam or the religion actually encourages having more and more children, and one should not be afraid of the food and drink of the children. It's God that provides them and guarantees
the sustenance.
Their sustenance, sure.
Okay. Thank you very much, Irshavid. Thank you very much for enlightening us, actually, and answering these questions very patiently. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, and the rest of the crew. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be considering how Hezbollah bludgeoned the Zionist military into accepting a ceasefire less than 2 months after Israel began its ill-fated ground invasion of South Lebanon. In our first report, Amina Taylor sets out the sequence of events leading up to the ceasefire agreement.
The resistance in Lebanon has emerged victorious after the Zionist regime was recently forced to accept a ceasefire. The Israel occupation forces are withdrawing from Lebanon in defeat after failing to complete their war objectives. The latest round of official warfare between Israel and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah began on the 8th of October 2023, one day after Hamas launched its surprise attack out of Gaza. In solidarity with the Palestinian people, Hezbollah began exchanging artillery and rocket fire with the Zionist regime. And the scale of Hezbollah's actions only increased, with hundreds of operations taking place on the northern border of occupied Palestine, causing a mass displacement of around 70,000 Zionist settlers who were forced to evacuate. This became a huge matter of contention within Israel, as Benjamin Netanyahu repeatedly promised to return the settlers to the north, but failed to do so. However, it was only towards the middle of September this year that saw a dramatic escalation of the war by the Zionist aggressors. The escalation began with a two-pronged attack using exploding pagers and walkie-talkies, which killed at least 42 people and injured around 3,500 others. Soon after, Israel began launching heavy airstrikes on South Lebanon and the Dahiya district in Beirut, and an unprecedented heavy round of bombing was conducted to assassinate Hezbollah's long-serving Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. On the 1st of October, Israel launched a ground invasion of Lebanon. However, the invasion faced significant challenges. The resilience of Hezbollah forces, combined with the group's extensive knowledge of the terrain and strategic use of urban warfare, caused Israel surprise. As the ground invasion dragged on, it became evident that Israel was struggling to meet its war goals. The Zionist regime was seeking to redraw the map and create a greater Israel, which would have involved permanently occupying South Lebanon. They also attempted to totally wipe out Hezbollah and return Zionist settlers to their colonial outpost. In the end, despite dropping thousands of tons of bombs that killed a huge number of civilians, the Zionist regime could not meet their objectives as they faced heavy losses on the battlefield. Estimates from Hezbollah suggested that Israel sustained 1,300 human casualties and lost 59 of their prized Merkava tanks, in addition to other expensive military equipment. The number of Israeli deaths caused a mass desertion of their own soldiers. Alongside that, increased infighting and economic collapse within Israel weakened Netanyahu. In addition to international pressure and the launch of an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court, it remains to be seen whether the ceasefire will be successful. But it's clear that the Zionist regime has been dealt a serious defeat at the hands of the Lebanese resistance.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller, who's widely regarded as the UK's preeminent scholarly critic of Israel. David's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's Zeynep University and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. And I'm delighted to welcome today's guest contributor for his first appearance on Palestine Declassified. He's the Ramallah-based activist and commentator, Arab Barghouti. Welcome to the show. David, what's your take on why, finally, Israel's agreed to a ceasefire, especially when the likes of Ben-Gavir wanted to continue?
Well, they couldn't go on, could they? I mean, they were getting completely smashed on the border. They couldn't get to the Litani River, which was their objective, immediate objective. Of course, they wanted to go further and occupy Lebanon more generally, but they tried to get to the Litani River. They thought that would be more advantageous. In fact, the Zionists had been wanting to get to the Litani River since before 1948. That was part of their objection to the settlement, which was then proposed back in the day. So, but they couldn't get there because, of course, Hezbollah, despite all the mass killings of leadership, the pager attack, were attacking them on them every single day. So not just at close quarters, the kind of ambushes on the tanks, which led to all those tanks being destroyed, but also regular missile attacks, including as far south as Tel Aviv and further than that. And so they actually couldn't get there. They didn't manage to advance very far at all, and that was a problem for them. So rather than actually try and go further at that level, what they've done is pulled back. They bombed South Lebanon and indeed Beirut very extensively to punish the people there, but they couldn't actually make military advances at the border.
Right, OK. Well, Arab, I mean, we know that Hezbollah lost a lot of its leadership, but still managed to continue daily operations. I mean, why do you think that was?
I think if we learn anything from history, we know that the oppressed people will always find a way to resist. If we look at the examples of Algeria, Ireland, South Africa, I don't think that apartheid regimes or violence or oppression or occupation are the right tools to deal with resistance. I think that the only tool to deal with any resistance is to stop the oppression and stop the occupation. And I think that until the Israeli government understands that, we will always be in a cycle of violence. The only way to end the cycle of violence is for them to understand that resistance can't be defeated by blowing up cities and infrastructures and killing civilians. It can be dealt with only by ending their oppression and occupation.
David, Israel's ground invasion faced, I mean, considerable problems, didn't it? I mean, many of its soldiers were killed and indeed wounded. A lot of its military equipment was destroyed as well. I mean, do you think that just made the mission just too costly for them?
Well, I think it was very costly for them. Yes, of course, there was the dead IDF people and the mass use of helicopters to evacuate people to hospitals filling up with wounded and all of that stuff. And of course the reports that we saw of mutinies of people refusing to go in and being too scared of not being able to actually cope with the resistance that was put up by Hezbollah. So of course all of that's true. But we also see, of course, that they pursued this strategy. It didn't work, and so what they've done is they've decided to pursue a different strategy. And that different strategy, of course, is to activate the Syrian front. And if we look back, if we think about this, well, at the time they were starting to go into Lebanon, they were bombing the border between Syria and Lebanon in the north of Lebanon. And it didn't really seem clear what that was for, but now we see what that was for. It was to disrupt the possibility of Hezbollah aiding the Syrians, or Syria aiding Hezbollah in Lebanon. And what they're trying to do is divide the fronts and to peel Syria off. And that's why they've activated these terrorists, as they're called in Syria, who are being developed by the Turks, and who, of course, that's being done in alliance with the US and indeed with Israel itself.
Of course, yes. Well, Arab, I mean, we know this ceasefire is fragile, and Israel's already broken it on numerous occasions since it was announced. I mean, is that normal?
For Israel, unfortunately, yes. We need to be very clear with the Israeli intention. It hasn't been changed ever. The Israeli intention has always been to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian people, to steal as much land of historical Palestine as they can, and they are going for it. And this, the violation of the last ceasefire with Lebanon is just another example of how the Israelis do not respect whenever they sign on a certain agreement.
Well, David, I'm sure you're familiar with the old saying that pride comes before a fall. And, we saw Zionist extremists talking about creating the greater Israel and so on. It hasn't quite worked out that way for them, though, has it?
It hasn't. Of course, that's still what they want to do. They weren't necessarily thinking that they could just do it next week. I mean, no. They've got a long-term plan, and of course, what they will do is they will try us in Lebanon or in Syria or other places to try and help them with their plan. But no, it hasn't worked out as they expected, and it's funny, isn't it? I mean, they continually do this. They think, oh well, we'll just walk into Lebanon, and it'll be fine. And then they're defeated. Like, they thought they could just flatten Gaza, and that would just destroy the resistance. Mm. And it hasn't destroyed the resistance. And they don't get that. They keep failing to understand that at military level they cannot win against the resistance. And that's their problem. And there we are. They've had to withdraw.
This is kind of politicians pushing the military in a way which they're incapable of delivering for them, is it?
The military are sceptical, and they've been saying this all the way through. There's been all sorts of conflict between, and that's why, of course, Gallant went as defence minister, because the IDF was saying, no, we can't do this. But nevertheless, it's still the case that the IDF believes that they can win militarily, and this is their strategy. And if they don't win a hand-to-hand conflict, they send in the bombers and the bunker buster bombers, which they're getting from the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, Arab, I mean, we saw reports from Gaza that Palestinians there were happy to see a ceasefire coming into being in Lebanon. I mean, why do you think that is, especially since they might now face more pressure from Israel as a result?
It's because I think that the people of Gaza really value and appreciate the sacrifices that the great Lebanese people have done. Yeah. I think it was a glimpse of hope to see the Lebanese people fighting for Gaza and fighting for the Palestinian people and sacrificing their loved ones. Thousands of Lebanese people have been killed by the criminal Israeli government. And the other reason is because the people of Gaza saw this as maybe something that might happen to them, which is the ceasefire and stopping the genocide and all of that. So it gave them some hope that this is possible for the Israeli killing machine to stop finally.
Well, our next report explains the origins of Hezbollah and the aftermath of Israel's latest murderous bombardment.
The Zionist regime's defeat in Lebanon is by no means its first. Israel has a long history of aggression in Lebanon, which predates the existence of the Hezbollah resistance movement. Israel's aggression in Lebanon first erupted in 1978, 3 years after the beginning of the Lebanese Civil War. Israel aimed to secure its northern borders against the Palestine Liberation Organization, or PLO. which operated out of Lebanon. And in 1982, Israel launched a further invasion in collaboration with Lebanese Christian militias. It was then that Hezbollah was formed as a way to fight the Zionist invasion, which had caused the humanitarian crisis as villages in South Lebanon were destroyed and large numbers of people were displaced. The Zionist occupation lasted until the year 2000. During those 18 years of occupation, Hezbollah gained popularity among the Lebanese Shia community through the provision of social services and commitment to fighting Israel. The result of that resistance was Israel's retreat and withdrawal from Lebanon in May 2000. That was a significant defeat for the Zionist regime. It was the first time that a non-state actor had caused Israel to retreat from occupied territory. Then in 2006, when the July War was sparked by Hezbollah's cross-border raid, abduction of Israeli soldiers, Israel was defeated after a month of intense airstrikes and ground incursions. The war concluded with a UN-brokered ceasefire, and Hezbollah emerged with enhanced credibility, viewed by many in Lebanon and the broader Arab world as a bulwark against Zionist aggression. After 2006, Hezbollah grew into the most powerful non-state military force in West Asia, training thousands of fighters and building up an arsenal of weapons. But the most recent aggression from Israel was unprecedented. Hezbollah took a number of blows, losing its senior command and facing surprise challenges like the pager and walkie-talkie attacks. Israel also used a new arsenal of U.S.-supplied bunker-busting bombs to cause devastation through mass civilian casualties and damage to buildings and infrastructure. But in spite of the immense difficulties, Hezbollah continued to launch daily operations against Israel and inflicted a large number of losses on the Israel occupation forces. Once again, Israel found itself unable to do more than cause death and destruction. The Zionist regime was unable to fulfill its war goals, and it failed to reoccupy South Lebanon. But in spite of Israel's defeat, Lebanon is reeling from the mass destruction left in the wake of the Zionist terror campaign.
Arab, Israel was previously forced to end its military campaigns in Lebanon in the years 2000 and 2006, and now again in 2024. I mean, was it the Lebanese resistance or outside pressure that was the key factor in those retreats, or a combination of the both?
I honestly think it's a combination of both. Of course, the resistance usually puts so much pressure on the oppressor, like the Israeli government. I think that they didn't expect the Lebanese resistance to be this stubborn and this strong. But at the same time, of course, the outside pressure played a role in that. And we were hoping that that outside pressure would have the same energy and the same effort regarding Gaza. We are hoping now that the killing would stop. And to gain our freedom and finally, because the sacrifices that have been made by the people of Gaza, but also the people of the West Bank, the political prisoners that are inside prison, the Palestinians that are getting discriminated against in Jerusalem and in Israel, these sacrifices are worth great results at the end of this darkness. And we're really hoping that these results will end up with Palestinian freedom. We can live finally with dignity. We can have our own state. We can be proud of our identity as Palestinians, because this is something that we would never give up on.
Well, David, how significant was the 2006 war, do you think, in solidifying Hezbollah's position as a regional power in the region?
Well, if you think back to the 18 long years of occupation, then 2006 was a tremendous breakthrough, because it meant for the first time that Israel was being militarily expelled from its occupation. And this is the first significant reverse that they'd faced since 67, when they took the Golan from Syria, which they still occupy, and of course the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. So that was a first indication that actually that the Zionist entity was vulnerable militarily, not just at the level of international politics, but at the level of actual on-the-ground military struggle. And that, of course, has led to the idea that there could be such a thing as an axis of resistance against the Zionist entity.
Right, indeed, so very significant indeed. Well, Arab, Israel's recent use of bunker-busting bombs and airstrikes caused widespread destruction in Beirut and South Lebanon. I mean, would you say that was unprecedented? And how has it affected the people there?
I think it's unprecedented since October 7th, what's been happening. I think that the Israelis, we need to remember that before October 7th in 2023, it's a good reminder for people to understand that, you know, the Israelis killed hundreds, around 600 Palestinians in the year 2023 before October 7th. Yeah. And the Israeli officials and the politicians started becoming public about their intentions of ethnically cleansing, annihilating the Palestinian society, the infrastructure, the educational system, the health system, everything in Gaza, and no one said anything. And I think that even the Israeli government itself was shocked because no one is stopping them. So if no one is stopping them from doing all this killing, then this is a golden opportunity for the Israeli government to continue with their original project of ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people, because that's always been their intention.
Well, David, I mean, we know that wars have long-term consequences. So the humanitarian catastrophe in South Lebanon, I mean, it hasn't ended, has it, with this ceasefire?
Oh, it hasn't, of course, and it will go on. And, of course, we've seen that it's a ceasefire in name only, that the Israelis continue to launch attacks, tens, I think 60-odd attacks in the last few days up until the moment we're filming this. But, of course, we also face the ongoing humanitarian toll in Syria, where they've activated a new front. They are groups that have been activated by the Turkish government and supported by the US. Of course, the Kurds as well, again, supported by the US, and effectively CIA fronts as well, which are occupying a third of Syria and stealing Syria's oil. Yeah. All of this is an attempt to divide the resistance, to make sure that they can't help each other, and also to try and peel Syria off. And what's happening, of course, is that the UAE and the Saudis, staunch Israeli allies, are saying that they support the Syrian government. And the reason is that they've had conflicts with the Americans and with the Israelis, saying that they will try and peel Assad off, and mean that, which would mean, of course, that the supply lines of the resistance from Syria through Lebanon to Gaza would be completely disrupted. And that will, of course, itself massively undermine Palestinian resistance in Gaza and indeed the West Bank.
This is a sort of classic divide and rule tactic then, would you say?
That's right. I mean, if the axis of resistance is divided like this, then that's really very, very major. And it looks like that's not going to happen, thankfully.
Right, indeed. Well, Arab, I mean, are you confident the ceasefire will hold beyond the initial 60 days? I mean, notwithstanding what David's saying about the transgressions that we've already heard about from Israel. I mean, or do you think Israel only wants a temporary pause?
I think it only depends on what benefits Netanyahu or not. This war has been led by the vicious ambitions of a war criminal, a historical criminal, a criminal that will be that will go down in history as one of the worst human beings in modern history. And it all depends if it benefits him politically to go to war again with Lebanon. He will not hesitate to do that. If he doesn't have that benefits, he will stop the war. I think that Netanyahu is not only a curse on the Palestinian people or even the region, he's also a curse on the Israeli people, because they need to understand that Israel is going on a way to become a pariah state, to become isolated, to being sanctioned at some point when the world will finally wake up. And I think that the most positive thing, if we can find anything positive about this war, is the fact that the world has woken up. They have been educating themselves, the free world, people around the world, that realize that the Palestinian cause represents oppression and the good values in all over the world. It's not only about Palestine. It's not only about the Palestinian people. It represents the oppressed people all over the world.
Well, David, I mean, despite Israel's air power, I mean, they don't seem able, do they? I mean, we've just been touching on this, haven't we? But you might want to just expand on it a little bit more to face local resistance on the ground. And we know the army's had mass desertions. I mean, what are the implications, do you think, of their plans, you know, to create the sort of greater Israel? I mean, you know, they're talking about redrawing the map, weren't they, and so on. And, you know, that's clearly not working. But what's their long-term scenario, do you think?
I mean, yes, at the level of hand-to-hand fighting and face-to-face fighting, they're going to lose. But at the level of air power, then that's not the case. And, you know, like, of course, the reason they've got air power is because the resistance in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Iraq, doesn't have effective anti-aircraft weaponry. And, of course, that would be a game-changer were that to be brought about. But there's no real way of doing that because of the immense cost. And, of course, it means that you have to move from a more guerrilla operation to a more sort of static army sort of operation. And the resources required for that and the amount of people required for that is too great. So that's a real difficulty, is that they have an air superiority in the region. And that's the key question, is whether that can be ameliorated or degraded, and whether there can be surface-to-air missiles launches, which can be shoulder-launched, etc. There is the technology for that. And that's a key question for the future, is whether it's going to be possible to actually intervene in the air power which the Israelis have. Because if they could do that, then that would mean that they couldn't keep bombing Damascus, and they couldn't keep bombing Beirut, and they couldn't keep bombing Yemen and Iraq and elsewhere. And that would be a game-changer.
All right, no, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So thank you to our guest, Ara Barghouti, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A new investigation by Al Jazeera recently has revealed, with Airlift's and intelligence support, the US and the UK could be playing a key part in Israel's brutal military campaigns in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon beyond arms supplies. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. The website of Press TV writes, the findings of aviation enthusiast and UK-based investigative journalist about British espionage activities in Gaza with aircraft stationed in Cyprus reveal only the tip of the iceberg of Western intelligence assistance to the Israeli regime amid the ongoing genocide. Apart from supplying lethal weapons to the Tel Aviv regime to be used against innocent Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory, Britain has been at the forefront of intelligence gathering for the Benjamin Netanyahu regime to aid his genocidal war, something that has not been adequately reported. In October, it was revealed through military sources close to the British government that the country's Royal Air Force, RAF spy planes, have been flying daily over Gaza to conduct surveillance of vehicle convoys, streets and apartment blocks with information passed to Tel Aviv. In mid-November, the British investigative journalism organization Declassified UK released the first video evidence of a shadow R-1 spy plane taking off from Cyprus towards the Gaza Strip, confirming reports that London was spying on Palestinians on behalf of the Tel Aviv regime. However, these reports did not emerge now. In the early weeks of the Israeli genocidal aggression on Gaza in October last year, There were reports about British spy planes taking off from their air base in Cyprus daily and spending hours carrying out spying missions over the sea near the Gaza Strip. The data initially surfaced thanks to aviation enthusiasts who track flights via internet-available flight trackers. These trackers also aggregate military spy flights, although not all of them. Declassified UK conducted a more detailed analysis on the subject, which documented at least 50 such stories by January, and then 200 by May 2024. An independently constructed timeline showed that the number of flights was highest in March at 44, which increased later. One of these British spy planes landed at the Israeli Nevatim Air Base in February. Despite repeated inquiries from journalists and British politicians, including Jeremy Corbyn, the British government refused to reveal the number of flights and their purpose, justifying its complicity in the Gaza genocide, with tepid claims that they were helping to locate British citizens in Gaza. However, military experts pointed out that British flights have been providing reconnaissance support to the Israeli regime, including preventing the transfer of weapons to the resistance forces. This comes despite the International Criminal Court issuing arrest warrants against Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant, which has triggered calls for similar warrants against those directly or indirectly complicit in the ongoing genocide. Legal experts also argue that intelligence assistance makes them participants in the Israeli genocidal campaign, so British officials could face prosecution for complicity in the genocidal war crimes. Notably, the refusal of British authorities to provide any photographs or footage of the Shadow R1 spy plane in Cyprus made the case even stronger against London. Declassified UK in November hired an experienced cameraman, Alexander Leobojevic, who patiently waited for hours near the airbase and recorded the spy plane's takeoff for the first time. There was heavy military activity at the site that day, with Chinook heavy lift helicopters, a US Black Hawk combat helicopter, RAF Typhoon fighter jets, and a Voyager KCMK refueling tanker. Shadow R1 flights continued regularly, and recently tracker websites recorded 5 flights on 5 consecutive days from November 24th to 28th for just an individual out of 6 operational aircraft. The modus operandi of all 5 flights, as well as hundreds of previous ones, is identical. They take off from the British Akrioti Air Base in southern Cyprus, fly towards Gaza, and stay over the open sea in war-ravaged Gaza for 2 to 6 hours, after which they return with information. As experts argue, this is the known case of British, American and Western intelligence and other assistance to the Zionist regime. There are more unknown cases of assistance provided by the government in London to the Israeli regime in terms of spy planes, drones and satellites. These aircraft also take off from American carriers and other Western bases throughout the region and Europe, and major spying assistance is also provided by 4 British spy stations on the same island. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab reports a new investigation by Al Jazeera recently has revealed that airlifts and intelligence support, the US and the UK could be playing a key part in the Zionist regime's brutal military campaigns in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon beyond armed supplies. The investigation showed over 6,000 military flights were recorded between October last year and November this year, including hundreds of transport missions delivering weapons to the Israeli regime. The network's monitoring and verification agency, SANAD, conducted the probe by using open-source flight data, revealing the extent of Washington and London's involvement In Israel's onslaught in the region, which has massacred tens of thousands and displaced millions. That also shows that the UK accounted for almost half of the reconnaissance flights recorded over the same time period, with the US being responsible for 33% of such flights. Reconnaissance missions refer to an operation carried out by the military through an exploration of an area in order to obtain information on the zone it is targeting. Al Jazeera's data revealed that Israel only flew 20% of reconnaissance flights. The UK reportedly conducted these flights using Shadow R1 surveillance aircraft, which provided intelligence on ground movements in Gaza. The investigation also showed the extent of an air bridge built for Israel, vital to sustaining the intensity of the war on Gaza and the aggression in Lebanon. An air bridge refers to the route and means used to deliver goods, in this case weapons, from one location to another via military aircraft. Over 1,200 military cargo flights delivered such weapons to Israel, bolstering its weapons arsenal as it carries out atrocities. A window to Palestine.
Bien, ya estamos de regreso.
Well, we are back and we are going to continue learning a little more about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile. In this section, talking about the Palestinian women and their role in the Palestinian cause, we are going to meet Ana Harcha, a Chilean playwright, writer, actress, and teacher of Palestinian origin. I invite you to watch a video to learn a little bit more about Ana.
Ana Harcha is a performing artist. She directs, writes, acts, and is an academic at the University of Chile. Her great-grandfather came from Beit Jala, a Palestinian Christian town. They arrived in Chile at the beginning of the 20th century and settled in Petrovkin, a small town in the south of the country. That's where Ana's first memories come from, a family fabric store where people also came to communicate with the world since they had a telephone, a rare thing in homes in the 80s. In the middle of the process of creating an artistic project whose central axis was the displacement associated with neoliberalism and capitalism, she traveled to Palestine in 2022. She acknowledges that her life is divided between before and after this travel. I arrived at a place I'd never been before and felt in some way that I was returning to my grandparents' store. In Palestine, she not only reunited with part of the family that is still lived there, she also made contact with cultural activists. She visited Jenin and other refugee camps where she could see and hear about the reality. She took notes, and with those files, she built a descriptive text that would give shape to her emblematic work, Irreversible Palestine, Non-Existent Palestine. I rediscovered my Palestinian identity not only because of my family identity and other flags, but because the political future made me aware of the resistance and violence to which my people were subjected, and I wanted to get involved, commit myself to the Palestinian cause. I decided that this is the right path in the world.
Welcome, Ana. Thank you very much for accepting this invitation to A Window to Palestine. I know your family's history. I know that they arrived in here with the influx of the migrants around the 1920s. In this whole migration marked by a bit by the Turkish Ottoman Empire and the end of its history. But my question from you is about this silence. I mean, in all of us, between the third and fourth generation, there was a silence in our parents, a silence regarding the Palestinian cause. I imagine something similar happened in your family. I would like you to tell me a little bit about that and also what it was like to encounter your Palestinian identity and, above all, tell me a little bit about what that trip was like.
Hello, thank you very much for the invitation to the program, Daniel. As you say, this generation that moved here between 1920 and 1930, before 1948, It receives some information about the political issues here and there, but it is not very much into the creation of Israel. My family settled in the south of Chile, and they managed to preserve the way of life they had back in Palestine. For example, first of all, regarding their job for making a living, I have to say that they go around the houses selling fabrics in baskets without speaking almost any Spanish. My great-grandfather used to offer fabrics all for 40. They set up a shop with the technical business, the sale of textiles, the sale of fabrics, the manufacture of clothing, and later fabrics as well. They maintain issues linked to rituals. Like many Palestinians in Chile, my family is Christian Orthodox. So all the rites have the color of religion. They maintain the meals, the games, the way of loving relationships and affection, but they remain silent regarding what is happening in Palestine. In my grandfather's house, talking about the political issues in Palestine was not a typical thing. In all the family groups and gathering, there was always some individuals who had participated in various political movements of the 70s. Others from my home, my grandfather, Solomon Archer, for example. But there was always this silence. I realized as time went by that this was also out of protection. My grandfather wanted to have safety, especially for his children and grandchildren. And well, finally it happened that from my generation, and particularly in my house, I positioned myself socially, artistically and culturally with an unfailing relationship with the historical and political memory of both our Chilean territory and the Palestinian question. And then I began to activate all this, not only from the biographical, ancestral, family issue of roots, but also as a political future, as a political movement. And I began to work out that artistically as well and decided to go to Palestine.
What year did you go to Palestine?
In September.
In 2022, in September, recently, very recently, and I managed to convince my aunt, who had never been there in her 75 years of life. We traveled together, and I took a trip, which was a mixture of family recognition, of finding my childhood home in the town where I grew up. It had expanded and became large. I mean, all that culture that I experienced from living in my grandfather's house, playing in the store, growing up with those people, with those customs. I also lived that life in somewhere else in Chile, so it had everything I expect from a world. And it was really crazy, because I was walking down the street and I felt like I had returned to a place that I'd never been, as well as physically. And it was possible, I mean, returning to Palestine without having ever set foot in Palestine before. I felt much identified with what Lina Mirani wrote in her book, Becoming Palestine. When I read that book before the trip, I cried profusely, because in my process of identification with the Palestinians, something similar happened. I didn't feel totally Palestinian my whole life or identified with what was Palestinian. It was something that happened out of desire and for commitment to life, too. And when I was walking there and suddenly I felt like a Palestinian, I saw a person and I said, he's like my uncle Fares, or a woman who was like my aunt Miriam, my aunt Julia. They were all the same as my house, but it was like a world to me. Then it was like the childhood memory came to life 2 years ago. My family is from Bait Jala. They have the Angeles Hotel there in Bait Jala. And from Bait Jala, I travel to see the cities in the West Bank and to get to know the group of artists that I wanted to know, who I know worked in the refugee camps and who all generate all that which they themselves call cultural resistance.
What did you see in particular about the Palestinian women on that trip? Because for the Palestinian woman, to exist is to resist, right? They may have more than one fight simultaneously. Palestinian society is a very sexist, conservative society, and they have a struggle there that they have been fighting for decades. But there's also the fact that they do many things like having a child, sending them to school, doing journalism, doing arts, being professionals. And in short, the professionalization rate in Palestine is much higher for women than for men, and they possess a higher position in all families than men, and they play a fundamental role. How did you live it?
The point is that the West has created an image of the Arab women and Palestinian women that they're only repressed, only under the yoke of patriarchy, almost incapable of being independent and lack the power of thinking. Well, these things begin to change in my mindset as well. In other words, that it's like the image that the West has built since the 90s onwards of Arab women and Palestinian women. And it turns out that getting past Israel's military checkpoints at the airport with a veil is much more difficult than without a veil. So a lot of Muslim women and also my aunt and I were detained there for many hours, where they asked us the same thing over and over again to let different people enter. And I see the veil there not only as a religious symbol, but I saw it as an act of cultural resistance, as an act of political resistance, because it's easier to pass all those controls if you wear a Western look, right? Like with Western clothes. This way of thinking becomes stronger and intensifies when talking with both my family and the friends I already knew in the world of art and activism. There must be an awareness of the struggle that Palestinian women have had for more than 100 years, and now these women resist colonialization and resist the occupation. And perhaps we, from here, should ask ourselves, first, that we have to talk about the violence exerted on the bodies of Palestinian women, the supposed Islamic fundamentalism that oppresses them, or the violence that the colonization and the occupation generate over these bodies by a completely militarized regime. I met feminist women there, veiled and unveiled, who had a strength to fight that was often much more radical than what I have sometimes encountered. And I have also found people here who go out without a veil, only wearing shorts and the like. And there was a reflection that seemed very strong to me regarding the strategies that the patriarchy uses to tell us what is bad and what is good. These are the good women, and these are not. And the fact that how much is covered of our skin indicates how much we are good, that can't be easy. It can't be that easy for the patriarchal regime to resolve the issue of force, violence, and women's struggles through how much clothing they have on them or not, right? In other words, just because we can wear less clothes here does not mean that we are free from patriarchy. There's also patriarchy here. There's also machismo. There's also oppression of women and femicide and etc. So those women who daily resist militarization, oppression, apartheid and segregation are veiled. They are clothed, but they're fighters. And they're generating life through their struggles for their daughters, for their sons, for their families, for their desire for life as well. A beautiful girl in a cultural association in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem told me that they want, as patriarchs or Palestinians, is to stop surviving and living, living life like any other person lives anywhere else in the world. And I think it is very fundamental to break with those prototypes that are built here. Until 1990, the image of the Arab woman here in the West was not the double-chinned woman. It was my beautiful genius, right? The odalesque, the sensual woman, like a whirlwind of impossible passion, like resistance. And that materialized in images like those of Salomela, my beautiful genius. Even Leia in Star Wars, when she was captured by Jabba the Hutt, they take off her warrior clothes and put her in these odalesque clothes. It is in the clothing of the wild and enslaved people. But that ended in the 1990 with the Gulf War, and the question of the construction of Arab women only as repressed began. Then he jumps from the whirlwind of passion to the absolutely submissive woman. In the real lives of Arab women, many more things happen than those two stereotypes. There are people who live lives with much more diversity than those two stereotypes. Stereotypes constructed by cinema, television, and propaganda of Western policy towards the Arab world. There are feminist women's group there. There is a wonderful group, historical. There are some that are historical. There is a wonderful cultural resistance group in Jenin, which is the Freedom Theatre. And I had the opportunity to get to know its members a little there. We were able to invite Ahmed Tobesi along with Alejandro Saez, who is an artist from Valparaiso, in January 2023. She was doing workshops here in Santiago, in Valparaiso, in the 9th region as well. And Freedom has been organizing a feminist theater festival in the Jenin refugee camp for 2 or 3 years now, where the premise is the world through the eyes of women. There are artists that they invite from different parts of the world and artists from Palestine who work from the theater and who present their speeches, their desires, their struggles through art in this meeting. How many people here in Chile can imagine that in a refugee camp in Jenin, which is in another city demonized by Western discourse, a feminist theater festival is organized where feminists meet in a refugee camp in Jenin, where feminists go with and without veils? I find that spreading those images is vital.
Yo encuentro que contagiar de esas imágenes es vital.
Yo creo que Occidente tampoco puede imaginarse menos en nuestro país.
I believe that the West cannot imagine less in our country either. Our country has only been discussing quota laws for a couple of years. In Palestine, there has been a quota law for local government elections, municipal councils, since the 90s, since the early 90s. It is not 50% for each gender, but indeed gender law was already being discussed in the time of the war, in the 90s. No one could imagine Leila Khaled's role in the history of the revolution. Nobody could imagine that already in 1917, there was a women's organization that issued a Christian and Muslim declaration against the Balfour Declaration, which is the formal beginning of the Palestinian tragedy. Let's move forward. Before finishing, I want you to briefly tell me about Non-Existent Palestine, a play that is currently being presented in various places, which I hope will soon reach the commune of Recoleta. I want you to tell us briefly about what it is about.
¿De qué se trata?
Palestina irreversible, Palestina inexistente.
Irreversible Palestine, Non-Existent Palestine, is a theatrical work that I do. I started working on it immediately after the trip. I spent a month in 2022 in September in the West Bank, in many places, in many cities. That's why I went for a month, because I needed to have time to move while knowing all the time restrictions that there are on movement due to the issue of the wall and the checkpoints, the military checkpoints and the movement control that is always there. And during the trip, I took a lot of photographic recording from an amateur's place. I'm not a professional photographer. But with a camera, a good camera that I bought, I started my work and I wrote a memory of the trip. And upon returning, talking with Andrea Gidash about the trip, we set out to generate this experience. Then I began to write a text, which came out like that, like a whirlwind, just like that. That is, as if the text was written right from the heart of the experiences I had, from the premises of the history of the experience, of something that my aunts and uncles had told me before the trip. Those who had already gone there would always say that your life is always going to be divided before and after visiting Palestine. I thought they were exaggerating about this claim and what I thought hit me in the face, because my life did become a before and after of Palestine. And that is why I decided to name the work Irreversible Palestine, at the same time as Non-Existent Palestine. That's because one sees there, before their very eyes, the reality of the operation that the regime of Israel is fulfilling, that it's erasing Palestine. What you've seen is the terrible videos out there, appears before your eyes as an irrefutable reality. This manifests in a genocide that is currently taking place in an intensified way in the Gaza Strip. In fact, this has been happening there for more than 75 years. But it's not limited to taking lives in Palestine, but cultural genocide, which has to do with the memory and the history of that place. And then I decided to make a travel chronicle, but theatrically. And this travel chronicle works with the irreversibility of the Palestinian experience, the problem of erasure and what they want to make disappear, the need to make appear what they want to make disappear, and the relationships that can be found between processes that are being experienced there of the regime's violence against the people, with state violence against the people that occurs here in Latin America as well. And that is not a strange idea of mine that has occurred to me from nothing. But it is something that you talk about with the activists there. It is very beautiful to see certain networks of solidarity that exist from the refugee camps with places of struggle and resistance here in Latin America.
In Gualmapu.
In Gualmapu. Asma was in Gualmapu and was working.